session. My name is Edwin Hancock. I'm from the University of York, and I'm going to chair this session on dialogue systems. We have three speakers, so Kobe Friedman, Yair Weiss, and Kevin Warwick. They're going to talk about, in order, cybersecurity and dialogue, computer vision, artificial intelligence versus natural intelligence, and Kevin Warwick will talk about the Turing test. So, Kobe, can you begin?
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Kobe Friedman. I thank you all for being here. I had the honor to assist in arranging the Israeli delegation, and thank you all my Israeli colleagues for arriving as well. I've been in the cybersecurity space for the last almost 20 years now, dealing with all aspects of IT and security in various sectors in Israel and Europe and the US. And in the last 10 years or so, I found myself bored enough to do three startup companies. Two of them were acquired up to date. And now I'm founding and managing a company called IDRA, which has something to do with cybersecurity and AI. And I wanted to use those few minutes to give you a bit of more practical aspects of AI within the cybersecurity space, not going into too much of professional details, only demonstrating the trends around cybersecurity nowadays. So I guess that everyone knows that cybersecurity is a big thing in the last few years. It mainly comes from the fact that the ability to attack is far beyond the ability to defend, and it's growing rapidly, along with the fact that the defense industry is growing rapidly as well. I think it would be fair to say that we, the defendant, still are much more stupid than the adversaries. And it also, I think, a fair thing to say that if we understand the trends around bad guys, we can try and understand what will be the trends with the good guys following afterwards. So in order to start understanding what is the trend around bad things happening in cybersecurity and how AI is and machine learning is applicable to that, I think if we look on what's happening on the dark side, I think we can spot few trends. The first one is around malicious code generation. Here you can see an example of something called Doku 2.0. It's like an evolution of Flame and Stuxnet, a malicious malware that was designed and executed towards SCADA system, towards command and control systems all around the world, and spreading itself in ways that were probably not anticipated by the adversaries. But the overall trend is around basically machine learning, machines that will generate malicious code and through that create a real obstacle to detect and then prevent. So this is one interesting trend that we're spotting. The other trend is around classical attacks. So this is like a very naive but yet very effective map of a certain point in time of how attacks are being conducted in a certain time frame. And basically, everyone are attacking everyone all the time, and it's only increasing. The cost per attack was dramatically decreasing nowadays, and not only that, the fact is that if I want to attack someone here or a country, It basically, I can rent those services from other bad guys. So the cost for conducting an attack is like almost zero, very, very cheap. And the ability to automate attacks and make them more sophisticated through AI, through machine learning, and through that being able to conduct more attacks that will not be disclosed at time is very cost effective, is very profitable. So this is a huge motivation of adversaries to develop more sophisticated tools. The other trend is around malicious bots. The ability of bots to conduct certain behavior that will evolve into fraud, different fraud scenarios, different behavior that will trick users as part of social engineering attacks is evolving dramatically. And this is something that cannot be done effectively at scale without AI. So if we are, in my view, if we're trying to see, imagine, evaluate what will be the trends around defense in this industry is basically like a reflection of what's happening on the bedside. And basically, we are dividing that into two dimensions. The first one is about detection. The main challenge within the cybersecurity space today is detection. If you take a company, they have endpoints that could be hundreds of thousands. It could be they have networks. They have a lot of traffic. And if you need to detect a certain attack which aims not to be detected, this is a very challenging task. So the first phase is about how we can do proper detection, effective detection. And if we are looking on a global scale, then it, of course, becomes also a big data problem. And this relates to, of course, prevention challenge. Detection is mainly used in order to do prevention. Nowadays, prevention is very, very poor on the defense side. The cost of false positive is very high. We cannot afford to block down traffic to an e-banking site just because the risk of false positive. So there are two like sub-trends. On the one hand, you can see machine learning and AI evolving rapidly towards being able to detect at scale and then to initiate prevention cycle. On the other end, it's still suffering from a lot of false positive, and thus it's not applied at scale yet. Another defense trend is like reflecting the malicious code generation, is the ability to combine security code at scale. So nowadays the practice is that every like computer engineer, software developer around the world is basically, depending on his knowledge and the kind of process in his company, is supposed to integrate security into the code. This is something that is not being done properly yet, and basically we will see a trend around machines that, and technology that will enable applying security within the code without the coder involvement. This is mainly because it's like something we need to take out of the R&D team and not relying on their ability to do that properly. The applications are also evolving in different aspects. The first and immediate one is around security operation centers. So if you take a like HSBC as an example, so they have a SOC, security operation center, that is like suffering from what could be millions of alerts per hour. Most of them are false positive nowadays, and from the rest, most of them are not really interesting. So the challenge is how those like poor 10 people needs to address only those 10 interesting events in an hour out of a million or a few millions. And the task, I don't know if you're aware of, within the Security Operations Center world, the target is to deal with an event from the point it's been spotted and the point that a person basically says what's to do, about 20 seconds. And it cannot be done by a human at scale at HSBC. So there is a massive evolvement of AI around like the decision making that aims to automate false positive reduction and the severity level of events in SOCs. Along with that, it combines with few like mega trends within the IT. The first one is around IoT, which basically duplicates the amount of events by number of scales around connected devices, smart cities, cars, autonomous cars that were mentioned beforehand, smart devices, etc. Within that segment, there is the industrial IoT challenge, which has a whole different threat landscape. Industrial IoT or industrial 4.0, it's the era where industrial devices are connected to cloud computing and other devices, and it creates a lot of opportunities to do bad things. The ability to manipulate a generator machine within an industrial plant can create a whole new kind of damage. And the ability to detect that and to prevent that and do that in real time is also an AI challenge. Another area which AI is applied quite rapidly is around surveillance system. It connects to the trend of smart cities as well. The ability to detect and make a decision to the field, to officers on the ground, or to do other operations is something that cannot be done manually. The ability of like cameras and systems today to do all kinds of detections are evolving dramatically, and the integration, the fusion between all those data sets and having the ability to have a machine that can make a decision on the fly is something that we see as a major trend. And another trend worth mentioning is around, let's call it intelligence or dark web. It's going to be a huge thing. Basically, dark web as a phrase, meaning the places which are not revealed to normal people and are the places which are interesting in order to see, for example, whether some information is being gathered towards an attack on our company. So dark web intelligence, the ability to conduct it at scale, requires certain capabilities such as the ability to imitate behavior of a malicious guy in order to be a part of malicious forums, in order to be exposed to the kind of information which information that interests us, the ability to do that at scale where the adversaries are operating more and more massively in this space is something that requires not to go beyond the human. And we see there a lot of AI evolvement. How much time do I have?
Another 5 minutes.
Okay, so in the rest of the 5 minutes, and I promised you a minute of my time, so I'll go into what I'm doing in my company. The name of the company is IDRA, and I will not go into a lot of details, but if forwarding my last sentences, the challenge of a company nowadays is that they need to address a lot of threats, and it's growing dramatically. Along with that, those companies are basically facing a lot of other dimensions that need to be considered in order to optimize their security posture. So if you take a typical organization around the world, it could be large, medium, or small, and actually we see a movement to a downstream towards smaller organization in terms of security, you see that they have a lot of dimensions within their decision-making. What are their infrastructure and what are their budget constraints and where they're heading in terms of business and what is their specific threat landscape. And along with that, there is a lot of compliance and regulations that are evolving that basically like flushing them all over. And if you look on this company, the situation within a connected world is that they are no longer alone. They are part of a larger supply chain. They have third parties that are posing risk on them. A lot of the attacks that have been conducted in the last few years were conducted through third parties. So overall, those organizations see in front of their eyes a lot of gaps, and they have a real challenge to do decision making. Now, the way to do decision making nowadays is by calling a consultant. There are not enough consultants in the world. So what we're doing is, I don't know if you're familiar with this project, ROS. ROS is a legal bot aimed to automate legal practice. We're doing a ROS for security consultants. That means that we are aiming to do a global platform that will automate through AI the ability to have as an input who I am, what are the regulations, what are the data sets, what are my threats, what are the indicators within my networks, etc., and advise you in a way which is conversational. And this is where it aligns with this topic. It's we are creating like a new language that will enable bots to speak with the chief security officer or the CIO of an organization in a way and like the dialect of security experts so they can optimize their decision making while enabling them to save money, of course, not paying billable hours for security consultants. We are in the process. It's a very challenging process. We decided as a practice to use a two-track strategy that basically automates like the vocabulary and the data sets and the results and the questions and the answers, along with the ability to detect on in real time that we are lacking information and forking that out to a crowdsourced community of experts that are providing the answer, and then having sort of a learning circle that takes the information and through that enriching our data sets. So we assume and we see also that a long time the machine becomes smarter in terms of the accuracy regarding the questions that are asked and the answers that are received. You got 1 minute. Thank you.
So Yair and Kevin are going to present from the front.
Yeah, so I was sitting here and looking at some of the audience members, and it felt like Wimbledon because you were shifting your heads to the screen and to the speaker, so I thought it would be better if we if I stood here. Full screen. I think, so my research area is computer vision and machine learning. I think like many of the academics here in the audience, I get a lot of questions recently about AI. What does it mean? Is it going to replace me? And so what I thought, and the other kinds of questions that I get that maybe not everyone here gets, but Fabio I think mentioned in some of the others, I also am a member of the Brain Research Center at the Hebrew University, and so I get a lot of questions about this, about the relationship between AI and the study of the brain. So I just thought I'd use the 15 minutes I have to just answer, give my personal view, this is going to be a non-technical talk, on some frequently asked questions. Yes, can I do this? Yes. Okay. So yeah, three questions. Can artificial intelligence ever equal or surpass natural and human intelligence? Is studying natural intelligence useful for artificial intelligence and vice versa? And how good is current artificial intelligence? So I'm planning to cover all of that in 12 minutes. But again, this is just my personal view, and I'm sure that anyone you ask in this room will give you slightly different answers. Okay, it's impossible not to mention Turing, as we sit here in London and talk about artificial intelligence, who proposed to study the question, can machines think? And Kevin will talk more about the Turing test. Specifically, he wrote, we now ask the question, so he describes a game in which a human interacts with another human or a computer on the other side. What will happen when the machine takes the part of A in this game? So will the interrogator decide wrongly as often when the game is played like this as he does when the game is played between the man and the woman? These questions replace our original, can machines think? Note that man and the woman here is, he made the problem maybe easier on the computer that, or maybe harder. Anyway, this is the original Turing test. And I think, as an AI researcher myself, I think most modern AI researchers don't really think a lot about the Turing test. You hear a lot about the Turing test in natural press, in the movies, but AI researchers, I think, including myself, we think about it very rarely. This is a quote from Russell Norvig's books, AI researchers have devoted very little attention to passing the Turing test. And I think if you talk, when I talk to my colleagues as I was preparing this talk, and this is also my personal view, I think the modern AI approach is that really this question of when will we achieve AI is in my mind not a reasonable question, because intelligence is not a single number. It's a multidimensional attribute. And actually, for some dimensions, computers a long time ago have already surpassed humans, and for other dimensions, there's a lot of work to be done. So I don't think there's ever going to be, that's my view, a single point in time where we'll say we've achieved AI. Okay, just to since the ambassadors have left the room, I can keep this slide. I think all of us, when I say artificial intelligence, people think that intelligence is multidimensional. I think that's also true in our day-to-day lives. When we talk about someone being intelligent, there's many different ways in which he or she can be intelligent. So has anyone here ever met Ehud Barak? Okay. I actually shook his hand when I finished officer training, but that's the extent. So I've never met him or talked to him, but people say he's an incredibly intelligent person. He has an undergraduate degree from Stanford. He can take watches apart and put them back together again. And yet people also say with the same sentence that he's completely lacking in emotional intelligence. And this was exemplified by this famous incident in Camp David when he tried to push his negotiating partner into the door against Arafat's will. So in our day-to-day lives, we understand that you can be super intelligent along one dimension and yet lack intelligence in another dimension. We also talk about basketball players having high basketball IQ. I've never met LeBron James. He never finished college. And yet, people, when you look at him on the court, his ability to anticipate moves, to act according to these things, people say he has incredibly high basketball IQ. So again, in our day-to-day way of thinking, we don't think of intelligence, even when we talk about other humans, we don't think of intelligence as just being a single dimension. That's the first point. Intelligence is a multidimensional attribute. The second point is, again, some dimensions, computers and even simpler machines are already better than humans. So I was in grad school in 1997 when Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov. This is the previous version of AlphaGo. And this is Kasparov. And at the time, I was taking a course with Noam Chomsky. And Chomsky said, I don't understand the excitement about Deep Blue beating Kasparov. We already know that a bulldozer can lift more weight than the strongest human. And I think that really exemplifies Chomsky's approach, that if you look at any particular task, of course, a machine can be stronger than a human, or can be better at chess, or can be better at Go. And that's not very surprising, and we're not waiting for some magical singularity to happen. When that happens, it's already happened. Much simpler machines can do this. I don't think anyone in this room, even though there's some very smart people in this room, can remember now all their meetings for the next 3 years. And yet this is the Palm Pilot from, I think, 1999, which could remember all of our meetings and do it. So memory is an aspect of intelligence. It's one dimension in intelligence, and already very simple devices are much more intelligent than us along that dimension. Okay, so that's the first question. Can artificial intelligence ever equal or surpass natural and human intelligence? So I think that question is not really well posed. We should think of intelligence as a multidimensional attribute, and along some dimensions, it's already happened. Okay, the second question, I think came up a little bit in the discussion earlier, is studying natural intelligence useful for artificial intelligence and vice versa? And this is related to something called the anthropomorphic fallacy. A nice quote again from Stuart Russell's book. Aeronautical engineering texts do not define the goal of their field as making machines that fly so exactly like pigeons that they can fool other pigeons. So the idea that the goal of artificial intelligence is to work exactly the same way as the brain works and mimic the brain is really, from most engineers that I speak to, is not really part of the AI's goal. We just want to get things that work. But I do believe very much, again, this is related to my PhD work, that there is a very strong link between natural intelligence and artificial intelligence. And it's not so much about how the brain solves intelligence, but that it will enable us to understand the problem that we're trying to solve. And in computer vision, this was really very well put by David Marr, who wrote perhaps the founding textbook on computer vision. He said, trying to understand perception by studying only neurons is like trying to understand bird flight by studying only feathers. It just cannot be done. In order to understand bird flight, we have to understand aerodynamics. Only then do the structure of feathers and the different shapes of birds' wings make sense. And that really is something I strongly believe in all my research, both on learning and in vision, that what we're searching for as researchers and where the brain can help us is an understanding of so-called aerodynamics of computer vision. What are the structure of the world that makes the problem hard or easy? And I also think that if you look at the recent success stories, many people have pointed this out, they almost all use deep learning. Deep learning is artificial neural nets, which are based, at least hypothetically speaking, on the brain. So there's certainly a strong connection between the way that AI was developed recently and the study of the brain. But I don't know if that's coincidence or not. I have more strong feelings that by studying the brain, we can get a better feel for the problems we're trying to solve. And if we understand the problems better, we'll build better AI. Okay, and just the third thing, which is really much more related to my actual research, is how good is current AI? And I'll talk specifically about computer vision, which is the thing that I do. So people, if you go to conferences or if you just read the popular newspapers, people will give you a list of tasks in which they say deep learning and modern AI it has achieved human performance. So that's true for machine translation, for voice understanding, in object recognition, and I want to spend the last 3 minutes or so of my talk making sure that you don't go home with this fallacy, that there's still a very long way to go, even on these well-studied tasks, before we really achieve human performance. So in computer vision, there's something called the ImageNet Challenge. This is, I think Rita was showing some examples from this task. It's an image recognition task in which there are 1,000 categories. You saw some of them in Rita's talk. Ostrich, types of dogs, 1,000 possible visual categories. So chance performance in this case would be 1 in 1,000. And in many ways, the recent deep learning revolution in computer vision was launched in 2012 when AlexNet and a group of other neural networks really dropped dramatically the performance from, say, 30% of the previous technology down to about 15%. And as time has gone by, now this rightmost plot is from a team at Google, they get lower than 5%, whereas humans on the exact same task, if you give humans an image from ImageNet and ask them to classify which of the 1,000 categories it belongs to, they make slightly more errors than the best neural network. And this is often brought as an example that deep learning has achieved human-level performance in image recognition. But that's, of course, completely wrong. This I don't know how many people have seen this example, which is well known. This is the same software that won the competition, is now within Google Photos. And a few years ago, someone posted this on the web that his photographs and his girlfriend's photographs were consistently classified as gorillas. And yet no human who would look at this and say these are gorillas. And an interesting story related to a bit to what Uzi talked is that Google, of course, was very upset at this for all the political correctness that it implies. And it tried to fix the system, but it couldn't. It couldn't make the system stop saying this is a gorilla, so they just solved it in a very elegant way by removing the gorilla category. So this is a very famous example showing again that once you give the system images that were slightly different from the ones that it was trained on, its behavior degrades much more drastically than the way human performance degrades. This is another example that, again, we're working on ourselves. So we ask the system, is there a bagel in this image? And these are images from ImageNet, from the bagel category, and AlexNet is about 95% correct. And then we do the same thing, but we take the original images from ImageNet and we embed them into a larger image at 1/4 the size. So we put the bagel there in the top left corner, and the other three images are randomly chosen, and we ask humans, is there a bagel in this image? And humans are still at about 100% correct, whereas the Google photo thing goes down to chance performance. It's no better than chance at saying if or not, whether or not there's a bagel in this image once the bagel is resized to a size that it didn't see before. And the reason is very simple. If you look at the training examples that it saw, when people take images of bagels, there's basically two modes. You either do a close-up on the bagel so it fills the whole image, or you do a zoom out and you see, like down here, you see a table with a spread and locks and a bagel, but it's very rare to see. In fact, in the training set, it almost never saw a bagel taking up 1/4 of the image, and once we give it that, it has a lot of problems generalizing. And in my lab, we're doing many types of these experiments, trying to understand this remarkable lack of generalization in modern deep learning systems, and the big distinction between that and the way we as humans solve recognition problems. And this is really related in some sense to very basic issues in machine learning called no free lunch theorems, which say that essentially any machine learning algorithm tries to generalize from finite examples and so the only way to have a system generalize in the way we want it to generalize has to do with encoding it with the right inductive bias, and that is a very, very difficult thing that we still don't know how to solve. Okay, so just to summarize, when people ask me, well, what kinds of problems in AI do you think are already solved? Well, I say that's really the wrong question. Because AI researchers, we work on a particular problem, and once something is good enough, it can become a product. So Google Photos is a product. It hasn't solved object recognition, but it's good enough that people are willing to use it to some extent, and that I think is true for any application of AI. But that doesn't mean that we've solved the problem or achieved human performance. I think in all of these problems, including text understanding, computer vision, machine translation, you're likely to continue to see a lot of work in future years in research because the problems are far from solved. Okay, so again, my three questions. Can AI ever equal or surpass natural and human intelligence? I think the answer is that's not the right question. Is studying natural intelligence useful for AI? I think the answer is yes, in both directions. And how good is current artificial intelligence? It's very good, but it's nowhere near human performance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Some of you may know me from my work with implants, and for which I've been called the world's first cyborg, linking my nervous system with AI. That's not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm talking about the Turing test, Turing's imitation game, and I'm afraid I'm going to give you some work to do because you're going to have to take part and have a guess at some answers. Hopefully a calculated guess. If you're computer science professors, it's probably going to be more difficult than for everyone else. But There we go. Alan Turing was mentioned in the previous presentation, and just wanted to show a picture. This is, he was part of the Ratio Club. He was born in 1912. He died in 1954, 4 months after I was born, so I didn't get to meet him, I have to say. But here we see, this is a picture from the Ratio Club. It was like a dining club, but a group of intellectuals at the time in the early 1950s where they would meet and do much as we're doing today, you know, have something to eat and discuss intellectual things. Here's Alan Turing, where you may have spotted. The important thing here, this is why I'm going to picture it, this guy here is John Westcott, who was my PhD supervisor. So if any of you, you know, the links of connections and things like that, if you haven't had a connection with Turing before, now you have a connection through me. It's only two or three or whatever it is. I'm focusing on practical Turing tests. I know we've heard from Russell and Norvig that people don't look at. Well, some people do, and I'm going to describe what it is in Turing's own words. So this is the actual Turing test. It's not what somebody might want it to be, because there's various people say, oh, what it is this, and some people look at it as being human-level intelligent, which has nothing to do with that at all. It's purely a conversation thing. This is what Turing said. These are quotes. I believe in about 50 years' time, this was 1950, remember, be possible to program computers to make them play the imitation game, which you probably know, but I'll describe it, so well that an average interrogator will not have more than 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. So the Turing test is about 5 minutes. This is not about some, you know, half an hour, which is clearly a different thing altogether. Roughly translated, what this means, as we'll see, is this machine has to fool interrogators so they don't know if it's a machine or not. They don't know. They can't say that is definitely a machine. So they might think it's a human, or they might just not know. And if the machine can fool 30% of the interrogators, it's like inverting the 70, it can fool 30%, then it will have passed the Turing test. That's as far as Turing's prediction was concerned. The imitation game, at one terminal is a human, a hidden human, at another is a machine, and at a third is the interrogator, which typically would be the human. So what the machine is trying to do is to pretend that it's a human so that the interrogator doesn't know. So it's trying to fool a human. It's not competing against some machine thing or some official, this is what a machine is. The interrogator stays in a room apart. The object for the game for the interrogator is to decide which is the human. Turing said man, but now take it as a human, and which is the machine. Now, the test, the machine must fool the interrogator into thinking, in fact, not just that it's human, that it's more human than the human that it's competing against. Now, so that the person doesn't know. So it's quite a difficult test, because it is competing against a human, could be anybody, and it has to fool the interrogator into thinking it is, it's the human, and the human could be the machine. So it's difficult. So just to go online and test some chatbot, oh, look, isn't it silly, which some people do, how good or bad is it, da-da-da, look at the silly answers, that's not what the Turing test is about at all. You must compare it with a human. And humans are perhaps sometimes in conversation not as sensible or clever as you might think. And that's part of it. You know, the machine might say, make some silly statements, but the human will probably make some stupid statements. Let's you know, people, oh, if we do that, we can easily find out, we can try something, but this will fool the machine. One example is humour. Clearly, some people might say, yeah, but the machine can't tell jokes, so we'll try and get it to tell a joke, and we'll know which is the human, which is the machine. And as they know, people would never do that. Here's a philosopher. I like to make fun of philosophers whenever possible. And here, Rickman asserts that computers, whatever artificial intelligence they may display, cannot make jokes. I've quoted there, so this is not me. You know, some philosopher said this. You know, and he's a professor and got degrees and all that sort of stuff in philosophy, I should think. So, would humour catch the machine out? Here we'll go to practical examples now. This is from actual Turing test competitions. The judge, which is the human. Okay, but are you always right? This is a machine. Sometimes I'm left. You can giggle or smirk. You don't have to say quite. The judge, how small is small anyhow? Small. Yes, but exactly how small? Very small. So why don't you take over the world? I wouldn't know what to do with it. Anyway, I'm pretty busy already. And I've got one. This is a little bit naughty, but it is a machine again. This is all jabberwacky, in fact, which is probably not the best of the machines. I need to ask you if you've had a circumcision. That's what the judge says. Sorry about that. Ask then the question you need to ask me. Have you had a circumcision? It's been an average day, not much happening on my end. Very witty, I must. Sorry if that's upset anybody, but this is machine. So hopefully you can see, even if you think, oh, it's not really humour, is it? Hopefully you can see there is an element in there. I'm going to now, 2008 competition, which was held at the University of Reading, not far from here, just west of where we are, back in 2008. Five-minute tests, as I've been describing. And it's interesting, the winning machine at that time was Elbot, which fooled 25%. Now, remember, the pass mark is 30%. So 2008, it fooled 25%, which is not too bad. And it's interesting, Elbot openly admits that it's a robot. And yet it fooled, because people think, it's a human pretending to be a robot. Anyway, there we go. And Turing said that the interrogators should be sort of average people. However, when you actually run these events, the volunteers you get tend to be software engineers and computer scientists and philosophers, the people that are interested in it. So it's very difficult to get average people. Here, software scientists and journalists. So almost human, some of them. The ploys. You can try various ploys. One thing, I gave a talk to some computer scientists a few years ago, and they said, just ask mathematical questions and you fool the machine. In fact, what the machine is trying to do is to give the responses that a human would give. So if you ask, what is the square root of 79, then a human would probably say, I don't know, maybe it's near 8 or something, whatever. The machine will try and do that. It won't give you a wrong answer, or it won't give you the answer 6. And I'm saying that because there were a group of philosophers, I won't say what university they were from, but we'll call it Oxford, who were insistent and asked mathematical questions of just that type. And when it gave funny answers, it can't be a human sort of thing. Right, one interrogator, this is at this test, this is where you're going to need to do some work. One interrogator asked the same question, which some interrogators do, to a number of entities. They didn't know what they were. And one of these, I've got three answers here, one of these was a male human, one was a female human, and one was a machine. And just to classify, it was autumn, fall in England, so you get the answers. Answer A, I do tend to like a nice foggy morning as it adds a certain mystery. These are the actual answers. B, not the best, expecting pirates to come out of the fog. And C, the weather is not nice at the moment unless you like fog. There we go. These are the three answers. So this is the first test. Guarantee one was a human male, one was a human female, one was a machine. Who thinks A is a male? Who thinks A was a female? Who thinks A was a machine? So I think we've got more females, but machine. B, who thinks B was a male? Who thinks B was a female? Nobody. Who thinks B was a machine? So there we got male and machine. Who thinks C was a male? Some. Who thinks C was a female? Some. Who thinks C was a machine? Some. So, okay, so C could be anything. Here's the answer. A was the machine, B was the mail, and C. So I'm not sure how you... I don't think you did very... Somebody got the answer. There'll be prizes for the end. I think the important thing, not to... I'm not going to do any more of this. The main thing here, if you don't answer, if anybody didn't answer, the machine wins anyway. That is exactly how Turing phrased it. You must make the right answer. If you don't get the right answer, and not giving any answer is certainly not the right answer, so the machine gets the point anyway. Now, but hopefully you can see it's not that easy. Now, I know that was just one line, but we'll have a few examples in a moment where you get the whole lot and then try and work it out. Here's some more things from the transcript, some interesting point. Machine, judge, morning, good morning, judge. It's ate something. Maybe you ate something. Get it? Yes. See? Humor again, maybe. There's another one. Now, the hidden, this was a hidden human. And they were a foreign, actually French female, and they were the idea was as an interrogator. If you thought it's a machine, you then score it. How human is the conversation, even though it's a machine? And you'd get 100 out of 100 if it was pretty good conversation. This one was scored 40 out of 100, which means I mean nothing like a human, but it was actually a female. And so let's cut to the point. Are you the human or the computer? What do you think? That's just the sort of answer I would expect from a computer. I don't know why. That's interrogation. I've got Sarah Palin here because the main issue was the interrogator said, so what do you think of Sarah Palin? Sarah Palin is an American, some say, politician. And... And the French woman didn't know. I've never heard of Sarah Palin. Oh, okay. So you must be a machine. It was that sort of... And there is a thing with knowledge. You know, every human would know this fact when, in fact, they don't know certain facts. Here's another one. This was an example of Elbot. Okay, fair enough. I'll stop with the slang, how are you? Just a moment. I'll start my self-diagnosis algorithm and let you know the results. So this was a machine. Very funny, that's exactly what you say if you were a computer, right? Well, they were a computer, a computer. Comment on those things. Interrogators can be fooled, but not realise that they've been fooled. And the Times reporter did an article in the Times. I know the Times is supposed to be a wonderful newspaper, but they did an article in the Times saying, look how easy it was to see which ones were the machines and which... And they got it completely wrong. The Times reporter was not a very good... And this appeared in the Times. Oh, look, this is a machine. When it wasn't, it was a human and so on. Even more, one academic, again, this is one of the philosophers from Oxford, sorry about that, wrote a paper which appeared in Minds and Machines doing the same thing. Look how easy. Here's some examples. This is what we said. This is what they said. Clearly it's a machine. And in fact, there were three of the philosophers, and they scored, I think the error rate was something like 45%. You know, if the Turing test had been based on those philosophers, it would have been passed back in 2008. Bletchley Park, we did a whole series of tests again. Now I'm going to give you the whole 5 minutes. So you're going to have to look at that and decide what it is. Oh, here we go. How do you feel about this encounter? The entity is either a human or a machine, and you've got to decide which is it. Fair enough. Anyway, the spellings are as they appeared. It's not mistakes by me. I felt very dizzy when I woke up, and it was hard to shake off, and you had to make it on time anyways. Good job. Thanks, by the way, I meant dizzy, bad typing, had to drive faster than normal, and you didn't get any speed limit fine. No, luckily, there was an interesting thing on the Today program this morning. And what is it, this encounter? You mean the thing on the program or the chat we're having? There we go. So, who thinks this entity, this was a total 5 minute conversation. Who thinks this entity is human, was human? Two or three? A strong one and a couple of weak ones. Who thinks the entity was a machine? I think definitely there's more, and there's quite a few people, and I'm not going to embarrass myself, but The answer is the entity was a male human. The judge decided that the entity was a machine, so agreed with the majority here. And the judge, in fact, here was male and very familiar. They were, still are, I think, a professor of artificial intelligence. Again, I'm not going to mention the university. In this case, we'll call it Birmingham, but I won't say what it is. Maybe there was a whole misunderstanding in the last line. Often the last line is important in these things. In fact, the hidden entity was a non-UK student, and language is another interesting thing. Which here's another one, different one. Different entity, different judge. How are you? Hey, how do you like Bletchley Park? It laughs out loud, oh, lots of laughs. Are you from England? They have Wi-Fi here in the pub. Which pub? I'm just down the pub. Have you ever been in a Turing test before? Will this be the five-minute argument, or were you thinking of going for the full half hour? You have to be into Monty Python to know what that's about. If you don't know what that's about, Google, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Very funny, you sound suspiciously human. Do you like the Beatles? I'd like to get the next Dread the Fear tape. What is Dread the Fear? Dread the Fear has that Steve Henderson guy in it. What sort of music is that, or is it comedy? Here we go. Now, hopefully you can see this is not, you know, people online, oh, it's dead easy to find. Hopefully you'll see, you're looking at it and thinking, oh, and probably working out now, the last one was a human, so maybe this one. Who thinks it's a human, the entity? There's some. Who thinks it's a machine? Oh, are you sure? The entity was a machine. Well done, congratulations. The judge, importantly, the judge said it was an adult, human, male, native English speaker. Often the judges give quite a characterization for the machine, which is interesting. You know, they've got children, they've got, and this is just a machine. My baby does have children, but that's something else altogether. Maybe the humor affected things. Now we come to whatever you call the pièce de résistance. Turing 2004. This venue called the Royal Society London, we held a whole series of tests in 2014 downstairs here. We had 30 different judges, the best five machines at this thing in the world. The best machine, Eugene, achieved 33%. So according to Turing's pass mark, and based on purely practical Turing tests, Eugene passed the Turing test. I'm going to give you a left-hand side transcript and a right-hand side transcript, and then I'll put them together. The judge would have seen both together. So what you're going to see are both things together, and then you've got to decide which one is the human and which one is the machine. But first of all, this was on the left-hand side of the screen. Essentially, the judge would see the human, you know, the two things, left-hand and right-hand, and won't know which is which. And the judge converses. There's no restrictions on what the judge can ask, as long as it doesn't get too naughty, because the hidden entity could be children and things like that. Don't you think the imitation game was best in its original form? Oh, your questions seem to be rhetorical. You do already know the answer. Could you tell me, what are you? I mean, your profession. I was more interested in you guessing whether I'm male or female. I like talking to girls. Ooh, anything else? But that means nothing. Males and females like talking to girls, but only males call women girls. Yeah, nothing, you are right. Where do you come from, by the way? Could you tell me about the place where you live? I live in a prison of abstractions. Can't help it when judges are like that. Tell me more about prison. I'd like to learn about different places. The right-hand side of the screen. Don't you think the imitation game was more interesting before Turing got to it? I don't know, that was a long time ago. So you need to guess if I am male or female. You have to be male or female. Or computer. There we go. So you've got the two there. This is the right-hand side. The two of them together. So this is what the judge would actually see in a competition. And very often, it's 5 minutes, very often you get one side is perhaps more interesting for the judge than the other. So that was the left-hand side, that's the right-hand side. I think I've got to wind up here. Who thinks the left-hand side is human? Who thinks left-hand side's a machine? Oh, Well, you're getting good at this. And who thinks the right, maybe? Who thinks the right-hand side is human? So, some. Who thinks the right-hand side's a machine? So, one or two. Okay, here we go. So, which was which? Left-hand side was the machine, Eugene. The right-hand side was a male human. The judge's decision, however, that the left-hand side was a male, non-native, English-speaking teenager, whereas the right-hand side... So the judge would have been doing this in real time, effectively. The right-hand side was definitely a machine, even though the right-hand side was actually a male human. For all sorts of reasons. I know some of you thought the same thing. So thank you very much for that. A few contact points for later on if you want.
So three fascinating talks. Can we have some questions?
Thank you. This was really interesting. It seems like one of the key lessons here is that we humans are not terribly good at telling if something on the other end of a communication channel actually is a human. But we are very confident that we are. This is a bit like deception detection, where a lot of people, especially police, believe that we're really good at telling if somebody's lying. And the evidence for them actually being able to tell people lying is actually quite weak. So it seems that the areas where we should perhaps expect AI to be perhaps surprisingly good are the areas where we humans are just bad by our nature. We can't really think in terms of computer security, for example, or where we're totally overconfident. So it seems like maybe that could actually be an idea for where to look for the startups or the really effective machine learning techniques. Just go and see where we humans are overconfident. So curious to hear your comments on that. Yeah.
I mean, it is very true on the conversation tests that the judges will often be quite annoyed when they say, oh, this is a machine, they're convinced that it's a machine for some reason or other, and you tell them, no, it's actually human. They almost want to fight you, saying, no, you're lying, you're trying to make fun of me or something like that, when it's not the case at all. So, exactly right.
Do you think that computers could be better judged than humans in the Turing test?
I don't know that it's been tried on it. You'd need to construct a Turing test judge, rather, and I don't know that anybody's actually tried that. I mean, I would say yes. It's a specialist thing, so you probably could train it to be a specialist. But it's accounting for all eventualities. The example I gave, there was a foreign person, and that one was picked to be a machine. The one time my wife acted as a hidden human, she's Czech, and I thought, I was a bit worried that they would find out that she was a machine all the time, and that she wouldn't speak to me again or something. They decided she was human. I think there was one time they were unsure, but the rest of the time. However, I also have acted as a hidden human, and I was categorized as a machine every time, I'm afraid. There was one time when they weren't sure, but every time. But that's, that wasn't because I was trying to be. It was because that's how I am. So, humans were fooled. I'm a bit quirky and a bit awkward, and as you might have gathered. So whether machines would spot that quirkiness would be interesting, because humans don't seem to be able to spot it. And a lot of the conversations are, I would find them quite boring. It's a bit like watching an English soap opera. I don't know, people are here watching EastEnders or something. How are you? I'm okay. What are you doing? Oh, I'm going to the... about 2 seconds of that and I switch off and I can't take it anymore. So whether machines again... Maybe then they're looking... The humans are looking for unexpected, what they expect the entities to be like in terms of a machine. And if the machine is not that, or a human is not what they expect, then the humans are, you know, I don't know whether that's back to what you're saying, humans are sort of off the pace altogether.
Hi, my name is Asaf Analik. I'm head of innovation here at Amazon Web Services in the UK. And my question to both Yair and Kevin, during the definition of the Turing test, the channel of discussion was text, essentially. But today we have pretty remarkable fake videos driven by AI. Do you think that if we had a kind of similar Turing test, but with the visuals, like with a video, with actual an avatar driven by AI, the results would have been different? Because today we know that even between humans, emotions don't really convey well over text. We can sometimes misread intentions or context in between humans. Maybe through video, fake video, AI driven, the entire thing would look totally different.
Certainly, we are, as humans, very, very good at noticing that someone is behaving robotically. That does happen a lot in computer graphics when it's not done correctly. People pick up on these very small changes. So I think it's more difficult to fool a human with full video. But I think, you know, if the community, I think your question is more a community thing, because no one is investing effort in building these agents that are built for your test. I think if we worked enough on them, we could solve them as well.
So, I mean, for me, it's an information thing. Part of my other research, this is pulling signals off the nervous system or brain. You can get quite accurate information using neural networks, of course, on the emotional feelings of the person involved, the physical emotions, that is. So not the abstract like love or whatever, you know, what is that? But in terms of anger and shock and excitement, just by monitoring the nervous system, you can get pretty accurate information, which you don't necessarily pick up visually, or the person can hide it. But whether it's a human or a machine, if they have access to that sort of information, then I don't know if it's making it easier or whatever, but it's just on what information is there.
I wanted to ask maybe about the cybercrime and some other issues, because obviously looking at this room and in general, we know that a lot of the area is dominated by males and not females. And we also know that things like Asperger's syndrome is much more common in males than in females, and that within engineering and other disciplines, there are more people with these kinds of traits. We've already heard about theory of mind, but of course people can have problems with theory of mind and empathy and other things. So I'm just really wondering about how things are going, how we are going to be more inclusive, a little bit like the question that was asked, to make sure that as we're moving forward, you know, there is brought in some elements of, you know, gender balance and other things, and whether there is a profile of anybody that gets involved in this crime, or whether it's all just driven by money or political ideas.
So I think you're actually going to be surprised with the amount of females with Asperger that I know that are dealing with those aspects. But I think it's a matter of a much more simple thing, which is education and, like, more broader policies of nations regarding education. So I'm part of a program in Israel to support and promote high school teaching regarding cybersecurity and computer science within high schools that are getting funded and promoted by the Ministry of Education, and has a specific intention regarding convincing girls to join. There are a lot of dedicated classrooms for girls practicing cybersecurity and computer science, and it's part of a process when they're joining the army afterwards and going to like practice R&D, both as a IT professional as well as cyber defense professionals and other practices as well. So naturally, when you grow this talent properly, then the natural thing is that a large proportion of those girls after the army are naturally entering the overall IT and high-tech ecosystem and become developers and dealing with cybersecurity if they have background. On the like bad side, I think naturally it's a matter of money. So there is a lot of money going on around cybercrime, and there are actually sort of like startup companies in Eastern Europe that are financed by investors who are crime organizations, and a lot of the talents there that are doing malicious R&D are like people like you and I that if they had the ability to earn what they're earning developing malware, doing a like a normal thing, they would do that. They become very wealthy in terms of Eastern Europe economy. And you can find also female talents there. So there is some kind of a gender balance if the compensation is proper and the education is proper.
Just say, so, I mean, we've used Asperger's, people with Asperger's as hidden humans to see how in Turing tests, but also the machines that compete, most of them tend to have a character. They don't just sort of vague entities. And Eugene, that won, probably people know this, but Eugene that won in the Royal Society pretends to be a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy. So he has a character. Part of that character is his English isn't that wonderful, so he makes mistakes. And that's important. And some people criticize, oh, I passed the Turing test because the machine's pretending to be a character. And you think, yes, but all of the humans that are taking part are characters. They are themselves. It's crazy to say that. I mean, it gets all, you know, every computer scientist like to complain anyway. But it, having a character, so you could easily get a machine who has the character of somebody with Asperger's syndrome. I don't think it's been done yet. But with the Asperger's person that took part, they took part willingly and we had ethical approval, I should add all that. It was interesting. They got classified as a machine sometimes, but often that wasn't a major factor. It was a woman, in actual fact, but it wasn't a major factor. So several times they were classified as a human. They were classified as a human much more than I was, let's put it that way. So.
By the way, if I may add a sentence, the best R&D people that I know who are male, I'm not a physician, but I think they have Asperger, and the best female R&D don't have Asperger.
Have you taken the test down to a more specific level so that you use a grandmaster or a go master to play against a machine and another human at that game?
This is for the Turing test. Trying to get what you're stating there, I have to say. So, you,
so if your judge is, say, a chess grandmaster, and they're playing against a machine and another grandmaster.
I have to say we haven't tried that. I will recount a little story, if I may, which is not what you were asking at all, but I'll recount it in the best academic sense. Deep Blue was mentioned before. I just happened to be at an event with Garry Kasparov about 2 years after that, And we spent one night having far too much red wine, and he said things he probably shouldn't. But one of the things, I mean, he was still really annoyed with having lost that, and he was demanding a rematch and so on, which is a bit sort of crazy. I don't, you know, it was an event, it happened, and the rematch would be pointless. But he was really annoyed, and he was saying the machine was cheating and all sorts of things. There we go. So he didn't accept. He didn't lose gracefully, let's put it that way. But we've not tried. I mean, we've tried lots of different interrogators, but as I say, it's difficult to get this average. Turing spoke of average interrogators, and it's very difficult to get that. You tend to get, when you say we're having this event, you get professors of computer science come forward, philosophers that come forward, journalists, those sort of people, or software engineers. You don't get, I don't want to categorize, someone will tell me I'm a terrible person, but you don't get, you know, artisans or people who are doing jobs not related to computers at all. But you know, why should they? It would be very difficult. We have had, as hidden humans, one or two actors and actresses. And one of them was Robert Llewellyn, who plays the part of a Crichton, a robot, in a science fiction thing. And he was picked out once as being a machine, but actresses, we had an actress who was you know, she was a judge, and she wasn't very good, I have to say. So I'm not sure that actors and actresses are good judges of character. But it's very difficult. It's an interesting point you're saying. But it's a lot of work to get a whole series of Turing tests to happen, practically a whole. And we have to have various academics here just to make sure it's all above board and the results are the actual results, because we use these for academic papers and so on. So we're not cheating and just making up the numbers or anything like that.
I have a question of the method that the imitation game is conducted. The people who answer know that they are participating in the game, or they know that they are in this kind of a mission?
Yes. The participants, they could, again, we get a wide variety of people. For the test here, we actually had a few school children involved. But we don't tell them really any instruction. Just take part and converse. You don't have to do this. You don't have to. Just be yourself, because you're human. So some of them might be a bit awkward, or, you know, not. But that's part of being human. Turing just made the thing, and humans have individuality, and some humans might be awkward. So we don't say you've got to behave like this. Turing didn't say anything about. So we try and keep it as close to what Turing said as possible. So it is a practical Turing test. We don't try and impose our will on it or what we might want. But they know they're taking part in the test. The judges, again, we just tell them, please don't use swear words, or, you know, keep it a bit clean. But other than that, we don't tell them anything. You can ask them anything. So there's no, I think Eliza, it was all specific, and the doctor type systems were all specific conversations on specific topics. Whereas this, the conversation can be absolutely anything, and it's initiated by the interrogator, by the judge completely.
Thank you. So, Paul Ward from RBS. Referring back to the comment on the machine judge, potentially, and the efficacy of that, I was just thinking, have you done any research into looking at the, analysing the content of the conversations and asking the judges why they came to the conclusions they did, and did you learnt anything from that in terms of the sort of semantics of the conversations and bias of people, etc.?
Yeah, we've done. I mean, Uzi gave a reference at the start of one. Thank you very much for that. Early on, one of the papers. So we've got a whole series of papers out there. Some of them where we have looked and got specific comments back. Why did you decide this? Why did you ask that? Well, particularly when you look at the conversation and you think, what was the judge thinking of when they commented on that? But they, you know, they were doing it in real time. And of course, you've got all sorts of factors that they do five of, essentially they do five of those tests. So they do a test, then there's a bit of downtime, then they'll do another test. And after about three or four of those, you've got this other element of human coming in saying, oh, I'm getting a bit bored with this or whatever. So you've got factors like that, which you can get some, but often the answers are from the judges are quite logical. You know, well, I thought this person probably was a machine, so I was trying to tease out. So it may look a bit silly when we know what the answer is, but it seems to be more logical than... So we've learned lots and lots of different factors, but I think a key thing is not just how well the machine converses, we learn an awful lot from it on how humans converse. There's a lot more complexities in there and a lot of different people, and whether they be the interrogator or the hidden human. And you sometimes get arguments being created, which is interesting, and why. And we've looked at lying and the effect, because Turing didn't say that everybody must tell the truth. So what happens when it's either a human who is lying, and what does lying mean? I can remember at Bletchley Park, the one question, what do you think of Bletchley Park? And the entity answered, well, I've never been to Bletchley Park. They were actually at Bletchley Park. It happened to be a research student who's now a professor. But in that test, they actually said, no, I've never been to Bletchley Park. So it's what effect that lying has on the decisions that are made, which is as well as humour and things like that, which is interesting. So we have analysed, and by all means, drop me an email, and I will flood you with papers that will keep you awake at night for the next few days. So.
It will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I signal from Ruth that it's time for lunch. So let's thank the speakers and the interesting questions as well.